from WNPR. I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
For a while, it felt like the wheels were going to fall off.
What we pay the Democratic National Committee to do is to run a truly impartial election, which they did, period, stop.
And I can't believe we just put the biggest crack in that glass ceiling yet.
Today, that boy has now grown up and is standing before you.
Most importantly, the home of the pizza and the hamburger.
World-renowned expert on right-wing megalomaniacs.
Booyah, Baba Booey.
That's some of the news from the Democratic National Convention out of context. I'm John Dankosky. You can join the conversation in the Wheelhouse, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, wnpr.org/thewheelhouse. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Back with me today is Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Haven't seen you in a couple weeks, Colin. Good to see you once again.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Susan Bigelow is here, a columnist for CTNewsJunkie.com. Hello once again, Susan.
Good morning.
And coming in just a few minutes, our special guest, Bill Curry, a columnist for Salon.com, our Democratic political analyst. He is going to be here to talk about his party as well.
He is here.
He is here. Oh, my goodness. He's just walking in the room. This is very exciting, an update. First of all, though, I want to bring in Mark Pazniokas. He's Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. He joined us at the start of last week's program from the Republican National Convention, and he's been in Philadelphia this week. Hello, Paz.
Good morning.
So how are things just broadly different this week than last week? I mean, we've been hearing some of the same stories about disorganization or worries about whether or not people in the party are actually unified behind the candidate. Do you see big, big differences in Philly than you did in Cleveland?
Yes, obviously the Sanders factor is the biggest difference. You have a major unscripted element to this convention. The Democratic Party in recent conventions has really outdone the Republicans as far as putting on these seamless shows to deliver their message. This year, you know, it's different. The question, you know, starting with the opening prayer, when the minister doing the benediction was basically heckled by Bernie Sanders people because she had mentioned Hillary Clinton in the opening prayer, you had the sense of you weren't quite sure what was going to happen. That does work on a couple of levels. You have many of the Sanders delegates who are longtime activists who are very committed to coming out of here with a unified message and a unified party. And then you have the newcomers, the people who are incredibly passionate, the people who perhaps have fallen in love politically for the first time. And they are another matter entirely. Some of them walked out after the roll call yesterday and, of course, gravitated to the media center, where they seem to be protesting against the media as much as they were against Debbie Wasserman Schultz and the Democratic Party. They were pressed up against the glass of the media center, and it was kind of an amusing sight seeing news photographers on one side taking pictures of them and them pressing up against the glass to express displeasure, but nothing exactly more focused than that, at least not in the moment.
I've noted that the media has been the brunt of some criticism at both of these conventions. Colin, I mean, I wanted to get Paz's take about what it really felt like and sounded like with some of these protests right there on the floor, but how some of this stuff played on television is, I think, important as well. From watching from afar here, what did you see about this party disunity so far this week?
Well, I mean, it's an optics problem. It's probably an optics problem more than it is anything else. And Paz probably has a better grasp of how real it feels all the time in the convention hall. My sense, for example, on the first night was that there are that the California delegation is kind of near the stage. There are some guys who managed to sort of get on mic and begin chanting against Elizabeth Warren, which seems like an odd thing to do if you're a Bernie Sanders bro, but whatever. But it's basically an optics problem. The question about how substantive a problem it is will play out later. We know, I mean, the latest polling indicates that 90% of Bernie Sanders voters are prepared to go over to Hillary Clinton. Now, the question is, how about all the other people? How about all the other people who didn't vote in primaries, specifically unaffiliated voters, various kinds of swing voters? How are they affected by all of this? To what degree were they under the spell of some of Bernie Sanders' ideas and maybe intrigued by him in a way that they're not intrigued by Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, for that matter?
Susan?
And I think the most interesting thing that I've seen is the fact that Bernie Sanders can't seem to actually control this, that he can't seem to tell his people or his most hardcore committed supporters to knock it off, that they're going to protest no matter what. I've seen people saying, well, we're going to have the revolution without Bernie. If he's not with us, then we're just going to keep on going. And that's sort of amazing that Bernie Sanders appears to be very good at whipping up these people, but not necessarily good at getting them to follow him where they don't necessarily want to go.
Well, and Bill, you've been writing for some months now about this political revolution and how it took hold. I mean, what have you seen in this as you've heard from these supporters of Bernie Sanders loudly shouting down the likes of Elizabeth Warren as she's giving a pretty major speech where she's trying to deliver a takedown on national television of Donald Trump, and people are screaming at her, "We trusted you." It sort of feels a little bit, as Susan said, like there's an element of the Sanders faction that's out of control enough that it is actually putting a wrinkle in what's happening in Philadelphia this week.
Well, first of all, it's hard for anyone to get a protest movement to stop protesting. If this were a parliamentary democracy, the marriage between the Sanders and Clinton people would be occurring after the election, not before. And it would be occurring with not just some promises but real commitments, personnel, policy that would be injected right into a government. So this is not a wedding with both families cheering as the couple walks back down the aisle. This is an alliance. And the second thing I'll just say is that it's not Bernie's job to bring these voters in. It's Hillary's job. In fact, only Hillary can do it. And the good news about this, I would just say, is I've been watching them, and I still worry about the tone deafness of the Clinton campaign. They've resisted everything good for them. Debbie Wasserman Schultz should have been gone 6 months ago or a year ago when it became plain what she was doing by waiting till the Sunday before they cost themselves. The platform concessions they made to Sanders didn't just mollify the left. Many of those are in the Republican platform. They are directed at the working middle class of this country. Not having Elizabeth Warren named a keynote speaker till 11 o'clock that morning or giving Bernie the spot of honor till 5 o'clock that very night. They keep resisting things. The roll call, that was cathartic. And that's the last thing I'll say. I think that the divisions we're talking about, when they came to the roll call, that moment was necessary. It's been a constant complaint of the Sanders people, not just that their voice isn't heard, but that their ballots literally aren't counted. To say to this movement, you're not going to have your ballots counted at the convention, was a terrible idea. And going through that last process they resisted, again, like everything else I just named, it helped Clinton. It helped the party. I talked to our friend Anthony Brooks, who was on the floor, and he was just talking about, one, the patriotic feeling you get watching any roll call and how moved he was by it. But secondly, I think it meant especially a lot for these Democrats.
Well, and Paz, you're there as well. I mean, talk about that emotional moment of the roll call, because for all the disunity, all the division, all the things that we can pick apart, there is this kind of really, Bill used the word patriotic feeling that comes with this moment, and also with this moment, a very historic one, nominating a woman to be president of the United States.
I think Bill had a better point when he talked about the catharsis. There is definitely a psychological element to this. There is a sense that they are processing something. I don't know how many times this year I have thought about Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and the stages of Greece, how people have been processing things, how the Republicans processed the idea that Donald Trump was going to end up as their nominee. And that's what we saw Monday and Tuesday here. Some of the Sanders people who are more establishment said this is going to happen. They need to vent. They need to think they were being heard. I think Bill is 100% right that they had to do that roll call. It was lunacy to think that it would have been better to forego that and have that bland moment where, by acclamation, Hillary Clinton is nominated for president.
I want to actually play a little bit of tape from Connecticut Lieutenant Governor Nancy Wyman officially declaring our state's vote. She used a time on the microphone to tout the accomplishments of Connecticut under President Barack Obama.
We are the first state to answer the president's call on raising the minimum wage that our next president, Hillary Clinton, will expand on. Yes. Recognize that this state, with the most successful, the implementation of Obamacare in the country. Yes.
Bill is saying to me, that's not true.
First of all, one of the original sins of the Obama administration when he came in 2009, when in the 2008 platform, the minimum wage increase was part of that platform as well. And when he came in 2009, we had the votes in the House and the Senate. There was no question we could pass it. And they made a strategic decision that it would be too offensive to their supporters in the business community, and they let it go. Just another massive missed opportunity to speak to the underlying economic anxieties of the working middle class, which is, along with political corruption, still what this election is about.
There was an awful lot, Colin, on that first night as Elizabeth Warren spoke and as Bernie Sanders later spoke, as they talked about the platform concessions that have been made, some of the things that the Clinton campaign has come around to, having to do with the economy, having to do with the way in which it deals with big banks. My analysis of watching Elizabeth Warren was there's an awful lot of stuff she delivered very, very well that night, including her takedowns of Donald Trump. The stuff that sort of felt like she didn't really believe it, at least to me, was the stuff where she believed that Hillary Clinton was going to do some of the things that we've never thought Hillary Clinton was going to do in the first place.
Right. And I think they never sound crazier than when they're talking about trade. Like all of them. All of them sound crazy, right? All of them. I was listening to a floor interview with Sherrod Brown, and he's saying, well, you know, obviously we're going to have some tough things to say about the TPP because that's one of those, you know, we just don't do well with those multinational trade agreements. Those aren't good. And I'm thinking, do you even know who the nominee is? Because, I mean, obviously she has reversed herself on TPP, and that was a good move, and there are obviously, you know, Bernie bros running around the streets of Philadelphia in parades holding up giant joints and anti-TPP signs. And, you know, you want to kind of take some of that stuff off the table. But I do think they sound a little crazy when they're doing this. I actually think the speech to watch tonight is the Obama speech, the Barack Obama speech. I mean, he's got almost as much on the line as Hillary Clinton does. You know, this point has been made by other people, but you know, if Donald Trump were elected in the first 100 days, he would undo all of Barack Obama's legacy, probably, you know, up to and including removing any portraits of Barack Obama from any national monuments. I mean, for Barack Obama, thinking about his legacy right now as president, first of all, there's this guy he doesn't like who's running, who questioned his own American authenticity as a birther, and a guy who would destroy everything that he stands for. I think you're going to hear a more ferocious speech out of Barack Obama tonight than you've heard so far in the convention from anybody.
Susan?
I think that one of the more interesting moments that's happened so far for me was when Terry McAuliffe, the governor of Virginia, was saying that Hillary's going to – don't worry, she's probably going to reverse herself on the TPP when she actually gets into office. And I think everyone who was kind of in favor of the TPP is like, shh, you're not supposed to say that.
It's like there was at the bottom of the card he was reading and said, but don't say that
don't
to anybody.
Say it.
And he just didn't read that part.
Yeah. And, of course, this whole mess over the TPP. This is I think that's actually a huge thing that Hillary did, was to sort of reverse herself on that, put it in the platform. That's a huge concession to the Bernie Sanders people, especially because I don't think that there's a lot of understanding about what the TPP is. Free trade agreements are these massive, complex things. Just to be sort of blindly for or against it, just it shows that people don't necessarily, I don't think, get it or understand it. There's so much in there. And I think that actually Terry McAuliffe is right, that probably Hillary will go back on the TPP. I think that's a good thing. I'm in favor of free trade agreements generally. But, you know, I think that there's also a sense Bernie people think that whatever concessions get put in the platform, whatever Hillary Clinton says, that she's probably not always bound to actually do it.
Two points, one of which is that one of the reasons people are a little confused as to what's in the TPP is that the Obama administration embargoed the TPP right up to and including the moment in which the Congress was voting on it. They did something you couldn't get away with in any other democracy. They didn't allow the public to examine the document. Another big mistake in my view. And the second thing, though, I just say is that the debate of the TPP exposes some of the hollowness and some of the intrinsic confusion of our political debate. One, every newspaper I've read says that Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump have come out against the TPP, and that's completely false. Neither one of them has ever made a blanket statement, and you can see every sentence that either one of them has spoken has left an escape hatch. They've only said they don't like, as you know, Trump says he'll negotiate a better version of it, which could be two tweaks. Hillary says essentially the same thing. And so, one, there's the hollowness of the whole debate, and two, there's the failure of any of the sides to this to explain what's really wrong with it.
And I'll just say it in one sentence. This is not about our relative parity with any other country in terms of quotas, tariffs, all things that you've been trade. This is a conceding of the power of the democracy to corporations. This is taking away from legislatures, Congress, government, even the Supreme Court, the ability to set policy over workplace safety, the environment, and 100 other issues. That issue of the continued corporate co-opting of democracy itself is really the central issue of the trade agreement, and no one's clarified it.
Despite all the chaos that happened on Monday, most of the room seemed to quiet down and come together when First Lady Michelle Obama took to the stage.
We urge them to ignore those who question their father's citizenship or faith. How we insist that the hateful language they hear from public figures on TV does not represent the true spirit of this country. How we explain that when someone is cruel or acts like a bully, you don't stoop to their level. No, our motto is, when they go low, we go high.
That's Michelle Obama speaking on Monday night. And Mark Pazniokas is back with us. You were in the room for that. Hey Paz, maybe you can just sum up, if you would, what the hall felt like as Michelle Obama gave that speech.
I'm sure it came across on television. I mean, this is a woman who is beloved, whose language has been emulated, shall we say, by the certain people in the Republican Party. It was a great kickoff for the first night. The thing that surprised me is there was that bit of, I thought, real emotion at the end, talking about Hillary Clinton and about to make history and set an example for not only our daughters but our sons. Those are the moments you cannot manufacture. These are television shows. Much of what you see in here is manufactured, including when Bill Clinton was talking about his wife as the change maker. You know, the thousands of signs saying change maker have already been distributed. But that struck me as something that was authentic.
Maybe in our next segment, we'll talk a bit more about that speech and also about Bill Clinton's speech. I want to let Paz go, but very quickly, Paz, you were to breakfast with a delegation today. Anything interesting when you get together with the Connecticut delegation in the morning?
The theme was about guns because Senator Murphy will be speaking tonight. John Lewis of Georgia, who is one of those people who can come in and people hang on his every word. They were talking about the sit-in. They were talking about how it came into being. Congressman Lewis and John Larson of Hartford obviously have a close working relationship and friendship, and they were talking about basically how they plotted to take over the House with that sit-in. These things are they're pep talks for the insiders, for the activists. But this was one of those moments where you see the delegates instantly jump to their feet out of respect for the history that John Lewis represents.
Mark Pazniokas is Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. He's covering the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Hey, Paz, do you miss me?
We're not going to tell the story about 92, are we?
No. We did room together in 92, and let's just say there are certain parts of the platform that Paz and I are very concerned about. We feel like we have a really special stake in that.
Mark Pazniokas, thank you for joining us, Paz. Have fun.
Wow.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
When we come back from our break, we will continue with Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show, Bill Curry, our Democratic political analyst, and Susan Bigelow from CTNewsJunkie.com. We'll break down some of the other speeches we've heard. We'll take a look ahead at what else we're going to hear during the DNC. And we're also going to look at emails and why emails seem to be the bane of the Democratic Party right now. You can join us 860-275-7266. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse, WNPR's weekly news roundtable. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia with Susan Bigelow, a columnist for CTNewsJunkie.com, our Democratic political analyst, Bill Curry, and also Colin McEnroe, who is the host of The Colin McEnroe Show, which you can hear each day at 1 o'clock here on WNPR. What's on your show today at 1, Colin?
Well, apropos of both politics and everything else, like the baseball season, life produces more losers than it does winners. But we tend to talk a lot more about winning than we do about losing. This is a whole show about losing, ranging from losing in politics to the way we depict losers in culture to, in fact, losing in sports.
Oh, this is so a program about and featuring losers this afternoon.
You're going to have so much losing. You're going to want – you can't believe how much losing we're going to give you. Give you so much losing.
So that's 1 o'clock this afternoon on the Colin McEnroe Show. Last night, former president and possible first gentleman Bill Clinton entered his element and spoke to convention goers in Philadelphia about his wife Hillary Clinton.
Well, she's insatiably curious. She's a natural leader. She's a good organizer. And she's the best darn change maker I ever met in my entire life.
As Paz talked about, that line about being a change maker was not exactly spontaneous. It was printed up on gigantic signs that everyone was holding. Bill Clinton perhaps spoke a little long, Colin, but we knew he'd have a very, very long speech. I guess I'm wondering what you took away from Bill Clinton last night.
Well, there was sort of rapt silence in the hall. And initially I wondered, well, is he not energizing people enough, or are they just really paying close attention? I ultimately decided I think what was missing from parts of the speech was music. So, Lydia, could I have my music, please?
After the class, I followed her out, intending to introduce myself. I got close enough to touch her back, but I couldn't do it. Somehow, I knew this would not just be another tap on the shoulder, that I might be starting something I couldn't stop. When I saw her again, she said, "Look, if you are going to keep staring at me, we at least ought to know each other's name. You feel me? I'm Hillary Rodham. Who are you, baby?" It was more of a slow jam, is what I'm saying.
More of a slow jam.
I just like to point for the benefit of CTN, I wore sunglasses for that. But,
beautiful. Yeah. That was literally very, very lovely.
On a serious note, and Bill and Susan will, I'm sure, have a lot to say about this. Look, as Harry Enten from 538 pointed out, you use conventions to repair liabilities. Yeah. And one of her liabilities is, in polling, people say that they don't think she cares about them. When they are asked, do you think Hillary Clinton cares about somebody like you? It's like 55, 59% say no. So one of his jobs last night was to really repair that idea and to demonstrate that she is a caring person who has cared for a lot of people before it was in her interest to care for people, back when she was, just coming up through the ranks, all these programs that she got involved in. That was a very important message that he was sending. And the other part of it was to humanize her. She's turned into this cartoon, this abstraction. He was putting some flesh on her skeleton.
After reading that, please don't say flesh again, if you don't mind. Susan?
The thing that was interesting about this speech, we've never seen a speech like this one before, because what Bill Clinton did is he gave the speech that the first lady candidate usually gives. The speech where the first lady candidate, the wife of the candidate, always comes out and gives sort of a fairly squishy speech about how great her husband is and humanizes him. And that's what Bill Clinton did. To see Bill Clinton, to see actually a man doing that, it was remarkable. I've never seen anything like that. And I think he did his job very well. If he ran a little long, I think that actually worked out well in retrospect, because the whole point of the speech was there is this whole other Hillary Clinton that you don't know. And I think that he was trying very hard to introduce this other Hillary to the rest of the country. Whether or not he can actually succeed at doing that for everybody else who's watching out there, everybody who thinks that they've known Hillary Clinton for the last 25 and more years, that's really hard to do. I'm not sure if that was successful, but I think the people in the hall got it.
There's a whole bunch here to ask you about, Bill. I mean, one thing is this notion of not knowing someone who has been so prominent in public life for decade upon decade since the first time I voted for Bill Clinton. That was the very first time I ever voted. That was a very long time ago. This is something where Bill Clinton is trying to reintroduce a person who has tried to reintroduce herself over and over and over again to the American public. You actually know these people personally. So what did you take away from that, and how much more can we learn about Hillary Clinton at this point?
First of all, can I point out, Bill feels the same way about his Roosevelt vote.
I just want to say that I'm really surprised to find that John didn't vote until he was 53 years old. Okay, that's a real – I don't know how you explain that away, but that's for another show. I've talked about this over the years here.
Bill Clinton could make a speech about Scandinavian housing policy sound like a story told around a campfire. He could talk a dog off a meat wagon, and the bond he establishes with an audience is unparalleled. I've never, in our time, I've never seen anything like it. Paul Begala said something smart last night that in all the speeches I wrote with Bill, participated in writing for Bill Clinton, I didn't really notice about him, and that is that he doesn't rebut, he reframes. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was such a brilliant observation. And that's what he did last night. And to not to put too fine a point on it, but the question about Hillary Clinton is trustworthiness. And there are two pieces about that. One, whether you tell the truth. And to engage in a discussion of whether she tells the truth was a non-starter. That wasn't going to be to go there at all would be like going to the problems in their marriage, which is not a good idea. And so what he did instead was remind everybody without saying it explicitly, by the way, character comprises many things. It comprises compassion. It comprises loyalty. It comprises industry, hard work. It comprises self-effacement. And to show all the other parts of her character that may, when taken together, make her a more trustworthy person. Those are all things you trust. And so I thought there was something brilliant in how he reframed it. And the last thing I thought was that, you know, Hillary Clinton really remade the role of First Lady, but not as much as Bill will. And, you know, First Gentleman, it's not even the right thing. It's not even the right thing. You know, it's not ladies and gentlemen. It's more like lords and ladies that the First Lady comes from. And in fact, he will shatter that role. Every spouse will get to come in as a partner and as an equal, not in the terms of power of governance, but as a person. So that was on display last night. He was remaking the role.
Americans are, of course, rightly arguing this week and last week over which party would be best to handle foreign crises and terrorism, which would be better to turn around the economy and create jobs. I think it is clear now that there's one thing you might not want the Democrats in charge of, the country's email. After Hillary Clinton's problems with email and the slow-rolling scandal over her personal email server while at the State Department to a WikiLeaks dump of DNC emails showing a clear preference for Clinton's campaign over that of Bernie Sanders, maybe, Colin, the party wants to switch to something like WhatsApp or something else that works differently than email does.
Right. And not only do this DNC hack have an awful lot of stuff that was kind of embarrassing to the DNC, it also had all the files for Treadstone, which is the organization that Jason Bourne worked for. And those are supposedly destroyed, all right? So, like, I don't get that. I mean, but this almost is like a Robert Ludlum novel, right? So, in last week, you have, you know, this sort of odd moment where Donald Trump gives this possibly ill-advised interview to the New York Times saying that, you know, as far as he's concerned, if NATO allies don't pay their dues and Russia attacks them, good luck, boys. It's been great knowing you. And so then you get this DNC hack, which, I mean, seems – I think we can almost say for sure that this is a Russian-orchestrated hack that seems intended to make the Democrats look bad and, by implication, Trump look good. Julian Assange is, like, right on the record this morning saying, I don't like Hillary Clinton.
That's amazing.
And so he's the WikiLeaks guy. He's the guy who's handling this Russian-collected or Russian-hacked material. I don't like Hillary Clinton. I'm timing all this intentionally to try to screw her up. I mean, I really do feel like – I know there's a new Bourne Identity movie coming out in a couple of weeks. I feel like I'm in it already. And then Matt Damon's on a motorcycle right now trying to get to Julian Assange and do God knows what.
So let's talk about this Russian thing. This thing is weird. What actually seems to happen is that the DNC was hacked by a group of hackers that has sort of a loose affiliation with the Russian government. And the Russian government has loose affiliations with all kinds of groups all throughout the country, including, like, they have a biker gang, for example. So then this information somehow gets to WikiLeaks, which is like handing a small child, a flamethrower. There's never going to be any sort of hesitation there. There's never going to be any thought about whether or not this is a good idea to release, where this thing came from. Things are just going to get set on fire because that's what Julian Assange likes to do. And then if you take that, again, like you said, in the context of Trump's statements about NATO, there's a lot of conspiracy stuff going on right now. For example, there's people thinking, oh, great, now Trump is the Manchurian candidate and he's in Putin's pocket. I don't actually think that that's true. I think that Trump is just very gullible and very easy to take advantage of, that that Putin and the Russian government are very good at taking advantage of people and very good at taking advantage of openings that they see. Putin is an opportunistic guy, and I think he just took advantage of this.
Well, Susan, I think we do have to say there's a lot of conspiracy stuff going on right now, which if somebody brought up 2 weeks ago, you'd say, that's crazy talk.
Yes.
And now it's like, well, it's 50% chance it's crazy talk, 50% chance it's actually completely true.
This year, I tell you.
Yeah, Nate Silver actually has it at 50% crazy talk right now on 538. But, I mean, quickly, Bill, to the substance of what we've seen so far in these leaked emails. They say, shockingly, that the Democratic National Committee favored Hillary Clinton's campaign over that of Bernie Sanders, and they said intemperate things about one another. That doesn't exactly strike me as, well, let's just say, all that newsworthy, given that that's pretty much what we knew was going on for the last 2 years.
Two things. I want to just add one sentence to that, and that is that Paul Manafort is a direct conduit to the Putin people.
And again, he's the campaign director for the Trump campaign.
And he's the chairman. There's so much evidence here. I know that it's all circumstantial, but in fact, when there's enough circumstantial evidence, a court will convict. As in so often, the media no longer does its vetting job. The FBI had to vet Hillary on her emails. Unfortunately, the federal district court judge who's vetting Trump University won't be in on time. And the FBI and the NSA and the CIA are going to have to vet this. In terms of the content, I disagree slightly with the premise of the question. And that simply is that people should stop pretending, especially the cable news people driving me nuts. They should stop pretending that they didn't all know that the system was rigged for Hillary throughout this. That when Debbie Wasserman Schultz reduced from 26 to 6 the number of debates and had three of them on weekend nights that no one would see, when they set up 36 state committees to funnel money into the Clinton campaign, when they ended the ban on federal contractors, when she spoke so dyspeptically about Sanders so many times, all this is just corroboration of what was going on and a reminder that the Democratic National Committee is just a pack. The worst thing in it, by the way, is just – it could be the same for both parties, by the way. But the window into the amount of time they spend doing dinner seating arrangements for rich people was just absolutely atrocious. And so that reminder that we – how much we're going to need an independent movement – because we don't actually have a political party. That's what the window into those emails showed.
Well, and I think one question, Colin, is – and we've discussed this quite a bit on this program – just the role of a party, the role of the Democratic National Committee, that is part of the more damning stuff in this, is it just makes you think, what the hell is this all about anyway?
Right. So in their bylaws, it says they're supposed to be fair. Bill's right at the level of reality. We know what's been going on. And in some ways, I can at least sort of – 30% get why you would do this. You've got a guy coming in who really hasn't even been a Democrat who wants the Democratic nomination. And people have been very critical of the Republican establishment for not stopping Trump, right? Why didn't you guys find some way to stop Trump? You don't have a strong enough party organization to stop Trump. So when we look over there, we think, well, yeah, how come you guys can't rig this thing better so that you don't have this maniac as your nominee? I think we do understand that they should have been fairer. And in some ways, the ways that Bill is talking about, to me, the sin that they committed was they did things that didn't help whatever their ticket was going to be. Yes. If you bury the debates, if you go from 26 to 6 and then you bury them on Saturday night, it doesn't matter who the nominee is. That person is operating at an unnecessary disadvantage. That kind of stuff, I think, is the bigger sin as far as I'm concerned.
And it seems to me like the party was trying to figure out almost what its actual power was, what they could actually do. And I think this is something that's been going on for years and years, the decline of the influence of party committees and the central party committees, the national committees, those sorts of things. Parties are less and less and less relevant. Like what Bill said about having an independent independent movement that's independent of the party, that there's not a party that particular movement fits into. And of course, a lot of people on the Republican side feel the exact same way. So we have all these political ideologies, political movements that have nothing to do with the parties. And the decline of the party is one of the big stories here.
Yeah, I mean, I agree, Susan's point, that there's no party that the movement fits into. But the Tea Party didn't fit into the Republican Party, so they broke it up and took it over. And I don't think something equivalent to that's ever going to happen here or anytime soon. But if a progressive movement on ethics and foreign policy and so many other issues were to be built up that held the Democratic Party accountable, including by challenging some of its most co-opted members of Congress, including standing up to it on policy issues,
I think that would be a turning point in this country, and that's what Sanders is talking about when he talks about a revolution.
One thing I want to raise before we take our next break, Colin, you know, leading into these conventions, often one of the more exciting things that we get a chance to talk about is who the candidates choose as their running mates. We get a chance to figure out whether or not they've chosen someone who, for some tactical or strategic advantage, will help them get various states or will help to balance the ticket, be strong where they are weak. But I honestly can't think of two candidates who have flown more under the radar than Mike Pence and Tim Kaine. Any thoughts on the Tim Kaine announcement just a couple days before this and what role he may play in all this this week?
I agree. And certainly in the case of the Republicans, if you shook Donald Trump awake in the middle of the night and said, who's your running mate? He might not be able to come up with a name, Mike Pence.
You mean now?
With Clinton and Kaine, it's early to say. And in some ways, you know, one analogy we could look at is in 1992 when Bill Clinton picked Al Gore. That kind of looked like maybe a dumb pick because Al Gore was just kind of another Bill Clinton in a lot of ways. They managed to sort of market themselves as these two young guys as opposed to George H.W. Bush with really great ideas and a lot of energy and just in shirt sleeves, working rope lines, shaking hands, going out there, meeting America. And my guess is that what Kaine is going to do, like, I didn't know too much about Tim Kaine before all this. He seems kind of likable and self-effacing and in a way that she has trouble connecting at a human level. That's probably one of the things that they liked about him. They like Virginia about him. There are other things they like about him. But that might be his biggest asset, is just to take the face of this campaign out and show a campaign that can meet people and engage with them. I mean, people say she's great at that, but nobody knows that.
All the coverage of vice presidential selections, again, in most of the elite media, will they get you a swing state? Will they be good for fundraising or as an attack dog? It's all irrelevant. What Colin said is true. Bill Clinton made Al Gore look more personable, and Al Gore made Bill Clinton look more principled. And when the two of them came together, two guys who were in their different ways flawed looked like the kind of future you were dreaming of. And that had a tremendous effect. Kaine wasn't my first pick, far from it. I thought that that Trump needed to be cautious, but that Hillary needed to be bold. He had to show he was an adult, and she had to show she could bring real change. But watching him on Saturday, I agree with Colin. The authenticity of the guy just – you know, I know that all politics is performance art, but having done this all these years, I sat there and listened to him, and the authenticity of his life and of his words, it just blew me away, and I think it could mean a lot.
I do think that it was a very safe choice, but that's the kind of person that Hillary is. She does play it safe. She thinks it through. She makes what seems to be the best possible decision. We're not going to see her go out on a limb, really. We're not going to see her make that daring choice. I think that's the way that she's going to be as president, too. I do wish that she had done something a little bit better, because I think that the Democratic Party needed something for the heart at this time. They needed someone they could really fall in love with. If she had taken the plunge and picked Elizabeth Warren, imagine how different that would be.
When we come back from our break, we're going to talk a bit about the platform of the Democratic Party and whether or not that actually means anything. And someone who's been very involved in the Democratic Party platform, Governor Daniel Malloy, his role this week in Philadelphia and some of his problems back at home. We're talking with Susan Bigelow from CTNewsJunkie.com, our Democratic political analyst Bill Curry, and our own Colin McEnroe. This is The Wheelhouse on WNPR. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow on Where We Live with Lucy Nalpathanchil, an exploration of the impact of climate change on flora and fauna in Connecticut and across the Northeast. We'll hear from biologists, science journalists, and from you. Have you noticed anything unusual or different about plant and animal species in your backyard? We're going to tackle climate change as it touches down right here in Connecticut on tomorrow's Where We Live. I hope you can join us. Today we're talking with Colin McEnroe from The Colin McEnroe Show, Susan Bigelow from CTNewsJunkie.com, and Bill Curry, our Democratic political analyst. Bill, let's just talk quickly about the Democratic Party platform. A little segue there from Lucy's show tomorrow. The platform includes some really aggressive language about climate change, about the notion that we have to engage in a kind of a World War II style effort to combat the biggest problem of our time. That urgency, I don't feel, has shown up in Philadelphia as one of the lead subjects. Maybe it can't be, given everything else that's going on. But between climate change, some of the other things they've put on the platform, what do you see in the platform? And frankly, does it matter at all?
You know, the first draft of the platform and the last draft of the platform are very different. And I read both, sad to say, in some ways. And in the first draft, there was no public option. There was no commitment to a $15 minimum wage. A number of other specifics weren't lacking. It was a continuation of a Democratic tradition of being very specific on cultural issues and not in the least specific about issues of political reform and economic justice. And the last platform that the Sanders people fought over, and again, that were concessions that Hillary made that will help her in the general election, is much more explicit. And the question with this, as with any platform, is did you really mean it? And unfortunately, as was pointed out with Terry, with the odious Terry McAuliffe, speaking out of turn within hours of the platform's adoption, that just stoked people's worries about it. Everybody, even people as astute as Katrina Vandenhoeven, will say this is the most progressive platform in history. 2008, we don't have time to go into it now, but 2008 was almost exactly as progressive on almost the same issues. The question here is one, whether you really mean it, and two, whether you can do it.
Well, and I think, Susan, we've already said a couple things. This whole year of covering politics has been about breaking from conventional wisdom. I mean, we just talked about how the calculus for who the vice presidential candidates is quite different than we've seen in the past. And there's any number of other things that Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton have kind of thrown out. You know, Donald Trump also said, I don't really care about the platform. Maybe it just doesn't matter. They can just have a platform, but then the candidate is going to do whatever he or she decides to do once he or she takes office.
No, and that's I think, something people worry about, that especially with Trump, who seems like he could do anything. Who knows what he's going to do? No one has any clue. I don't think even Donald Trump has any idea what he's going to do. The thing about the platforms is that historically, they sort of matter and they sort of don't. The things that are actually in the platform have a little bit more chance of actually being enacted or at least being voted on or supported by representatives than things that are not in the platform. Whether that's true this year, I mean, really, who knows? The laws of political gravity suggest that, it'll kind of all settle down, and things that are in the platform, if Democrats are actually able to get power, that we'll see at least a couple of those things actually come to pass. What I think it is interesting is that this seems to be a way to point towards the Democratic future, like what things are going to be important in 4 years and 8 years and 12 years.
You know, first of all, I defer to Bill on this. His Pequot name is Man Who Reads the Platform. The one thing that I guess I would say is that whatever its insufficiencies may be, you have to contrast it with this unbelievably retrograde and punitive platform that was adopted a week ago in Cleveland, which is like basically we hate everybody and coal is a clean energy source. And, it just like one thing after another, it tried to reverse almost all LGBT progress, 180 degrees, turn back the clock 20 years on stuff like that. And like over and over and over again, this is a platform which, if taken seriously and enacted, would really hurt a lot of people and definitely hurt the environment, give states more control over the federal lands that Obama basically tried to take off the books for exploitation. So, whatever we don't like about the platform in Philadelphia, wow, the one in Cleveland is like really scary.
And you have to say that, Susan, whenever you say LGBTQ, you have to say it like Donald Trump did, LGBTQ, he was having a hard time when he was giving his speech figuring out how to exactly put that acronym together.
BLT, BLT. Nice lettuce and tomato.
The alphabet is generally a hard topic for him.
Susan, go ahead.
That thing is that the platform tends to be written by activists, and it tends to be written by people who are sort of on the extremes of either party. So that's where the real action and the real momentum and movement is. That's where the energy is. So the danger of the Republican platform is that this is where Republican activists are right now. This is where the conservative movement has kind of ended up. And that's a very dangerous thing to think of, that these people who are really, really, really politically engaged are actually supporting this, like Colin said, this really retrograde, awful, very damaging platform.
I need to turn, before we run out of time, to one of the really important figures that we cover all year long who has a very prominent place at the convention. Monday evening, Connecticut Governor Dan Malloy spoke to the Democratic National Convention to tout the accomplishments of some of his colleagues.
In Washington, D.C., Republicans will block any innovative idea that has a scarlet letter D for Democrat next to it. But in the states run by Democratic governors, we're about solving problems.
So a good moment for Dan Malloy taking center stage. Obviously, as I said, Colin, he's playing a really big role in the convention and the party platform. However, he's facing his own problems back home, as John Lender in the Hartford Current reports. There's a grand jury being impaneled to take a look at the fundraising that we've been covering over and over and over again done by the state Democratic Party.
Right. So this was it's a complicated story, and I won't go into all the details, but it ended. The state investigation ended with a settlement that really failed to find fault, that assessed a fine of more than $300,000, except they didn't call it a fine. They called it a voluntary payment. Meanwhile, you've got a U.S. attorney here, Deirdre Daly, who has said she considers public corruption to be one of her big priorities. So they were basically just waving a red flag at Deirdre, like, hey, over here. We just weaseled out of a prosecution by, you know, paying a whole bunch of money. And just very quickly, you know, there's this story about, I think it's the football coach, Paul Brown, who, you know, told his players they was like going to be like a $5,000 fine if they miss curfew. And then he said, but if you know about something in this city that's worth $5,000, please take me with you. And I feel that way about the $325,000, whatever it is that's covering up, that they paid that amount of money, so I couldn't see it. I really want to see it now. And, of course, Deirdre Daly can subpoena it.
And Bill, I guess I just wonder, as Dan Malloy plays this prominent role with the Democratic Party across the nation, we're having a lot of questions. We're raising a lot of questions today about the role of parties and right now the role of the Democratic Party in Connecticut in the way it raises money and the way it campaigns. This is all coming to the fore once again.
Having the two most prominent governors at the convention were Terry McAuliffe and Dan Malloy, both of whom are under grand jury investigation for public corruption. As with Debbie Wasserman Schultz and everything I listed at the top of the show, bad idea. Just not good. And to go back to the Malloy stuff, what bothers me most after all the time I've spent on this issue and over all these years is the fact that still 10 years after Roland was driven out, it's still up to Deirdre Daly. We don't have the civic self-respect to enforce our own ethics law. The State Ethics Commission, the legislature, the State Election Enforcement Commission, and the Malloy administration itself ought all to be ashamed. And if what seems to be true
– And Common Cause, which endorsed this settlement.
Yes. And I was very disappointed, and I relayed that to a couple of people. This was the wrong thing to do. And everybody who's not drenched in insider politics knows it.
Susan?
This feels like a high watermark for Dan Malloy, the convention speech. And as you can hear, the crowd was just rapt listening to him. You could hear everyone talking in the background. No one seemed to be paying attention. But I feel like this was kind of like – this was supposed to be a better moment for him and that it actually was. But I do feel like after this, his role is on the national stage really is going to diminish. The scuttlebutt about him going into the Clinton cabinet. If he's under a grand jury investigation, I don't know if that's going to happen or not. So I do think that we're about to – that we're when we look at Malloy's career, this is going to be the moment that was probably the best one.
Susan, are you suggesting that the Clintons are the kind of people who would use Dan Malloy and then just discard him like trash
no.
when they got what they want
no,
out of him?
Of course not.
Of course not. Less than 30 seconds,
it's,
Bill.
It's been a supposition of all political discussion for the last few months that if Hillary Clinton wins – Dan Malloy is gone the next day, and I'd say we have two more years of him.
You have two more years of Dan Malloy here in the state of Connecticut?
Yes.
All right. Well, little over 3 years ago, we started the Wheelhouse as a way to talk with you about the biggest political news of the week. Now, from the beginning, it seemed obvious who should produce this show. The guy who gets in early, is constantly on Twitter, and is always engaging on social media with reporters, pundits, and politicos who shape our state. That producer is Tucker Ives. And after roughly 150 of these shows and many hundreds more episodes of Where We Live, this is his last show producing with us. He's moving on to take on an exciting new role as a digital producer for Connecticut Public Broadcasting. So thank you, Tucker, for your care and your nurturing of our often snarky and we hope sometimes sage program. And keep on rocking in the free world. Thank you so much to Bill Curry, Susan Bigelow, and Colin McEnroe for joining us today in the Wheelhouse here on WNPR.